Hi, I'm Alex Bellinger, and this is Small Biz Pod in partnership with the British Library on Thursday, the 6th of January. And so in this episode of the Small Biz Pod British Library podcast in the series on Going for Growth, we take finance as our theme with a look at both VC funding, venture capital funding, and angel funding, with interviews with Bill Morrow, the founder of online angel network Angels Den, and Daniel Waterhouse, partner at the European VC firm Wellington Partners. And don't forget, if you're looking for more advice on gaining finance and funding for your growth business, the British Library's Business and Intellectual Property Centre puts on a wide range of events, got regular workshops on managing your finances and gaining investment. Doug Richard, the former Dragon and founder of the School for Startups, is a partner of the centre and has taken part on many occasions in their Ask an Expert programme and also runs events there too. And of course, there are other partners involved in helping you find funding at the British Library, including Johnny Martin, The Funding Game, Message Lab, and of course, Angels Den. So do check out the link that I'll put in the show notes to all of the resources that are on offer there at the Business and Intellectual Property Centre at the British Library in King's Cross. So there we are. If you're enjoying this series in the Going for Growth podcasts, do let me know. Drop me a line at alex@smallbizpod.co.uk. Tweet. Feel free to tweet this episode if you enjoy it. Spread the word. Tell your friends. Share with people who might be interested. Link to us on Facebook and do all those good social media things. So there we are. Now let's go straight into this week's interviews.
Hello, my name is Bill Morrow, and I'm the chief executive and founder of Angels Den. Angels Den is Europe and Asia's largest angel network, and what we do is we find angels or high net worths for entrepreneurs looking to expand their businesses.
And of course, Bill, you do that by online, but also by a series of kind of events, and I suppose one of the more well-known events you put on is this speed funding idea. How does that work?
Yeah, I think, you know, we'll try and get the two parties together in as many imaginative ways as we possibly can. But the mechanism that we found is most efficient is, as you mentioned, speed funding. And speed funding is very simple. We have eight people pitching. It's in 16 different places across the world every month. And eight people, there's eight desks, and behind those eight desks there'll be one, two, three, maximum of three angels, people looking to invest. You then have 4 minutes to pitch your idea, and 1 minute question and answer. You get up, move to the next table until you've seen all the high net worths in the room. There are over 12,000 reasons why this shouldn't work. But as a mechanism for getting the money out of the angels, as I say, it's the most effective mechanism we've seen, and it's kind of like, you know, it is like speed dating, I suppose. It's that Malcolm Gladwell blink moment when you know, you kind of made up your mind in 3 or 4 minutes, and the rest of your time is just really just confirming that. And, you know, no one's going to make up their mind in 3 or 4 minutes. No one's going to give you your money in 3 or 4 minutes, but they'll know whether or not they like you and you've got any substance, and whether or not they think it's worthwhile spending some more time with them.
So what should businesses be doing to refine their pitches?
I think there's a number of things you really just need to get across. The first dirty little secret of angel investing, I think, is that it almost doesn't matter what your business is or what it's about. The person is not going to invest in you just because you're tech or you're farming or you're agricultural. He's going to invest in you if he likes you.
Yep.
So the first thing is just to be kind of natural, to strike up a conversation, to ask about the cricket, the rugby, and whatever. It's about appealing on some sort of human level. And then the second major tip is to, not so much an elevator pitch, but so many companies that we see fail to be able to describe their business very quickly. Mm. So, you know, we see some amazing businesses, just like you've set up, the revenue generating, but people still cannot tell people very succinctly what it is that they do. And that's really important, especially at the angel stage, you know, especially at the sort of the 100 to 200,000 pound level, because this guy is going to leave you and then go down the pub and his mates are going to say, what have you just invested in? And he has to be able to tell them very, very quickly. And that's kind of what it's about. You know, for them, it's about a sense of the humanity in the pitch, about actually something about you. And also they have to have an implicit understanding of what you're talking about.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So you get past that and you make that connection. And I know both in at the VC level and angel level, the personality, you know, the investment is often made around, you know, the individual entrepreneur and that sense of whether the investor thinks that individual has the ambition and the ability to take a business forward. So that's one thing. But once you make that connection and you've got that kind of rapport going on, in practical terms, where do you then take it in terms of a more developed document that an angel needs to look at to actually make an assessment of the business before they put pen to checkbook, if checkbooks exist anymore?
I think, you know, most entrepreneurs, if there are any true entrepreneurs, they'll be extraordinarily attention deficit, and they'll probably have really scant regard for the financials. Most true entrepreneurs that I meet can barely spell P&L and really have to get somebody else to do it for them. But you do have to get them done. You know, I speaking as an accountant and investment banker, oh, I know the evils of numbers. But you know, it's the common language that you have between the two of you. They'll speak numbers. They'll expect you to understand the numbers. And the numbers, you know, they don't have to be anything too complex, but it's kind of, you know, I'm expecting you to make five times my money. So I'm going to give you X, and in 3 years' time, I expect it to be 5X. And the cash flows should reflect that. There's a whole sort of sub-sector about getting your business plan right, about preparing your business plan. You know, as I've said, very few angels actually look at the business plan or certainly spend much time doing it. And I think, you know, we've got it, you know, we're by no means perfect and our mechanism is by no means perfect. But what we found is if you can answer 5 questions, we can almost guarantee giving you the money. And the 5 questions, if you're interested.
Yeah, go on.
Would be, you know, can you very succinctly describe what it is you do? So, I mean, don't bore me for 8 minutes talking about SLVs and 9291 diodes. Just very quickly tell me what you do. What is the pain in the marketplace? What's the point of your company? What pain do you solve?
Mm-hmm.
It's the second question. Third question, how do you go about solving that pain? So how do you do it?
Yeah,
you know, I'm really, really simple. These are not difficult questions, but so often people fail to get it down, or they bore about the product. No one's buying the product; they're buying the company, and there's a world of distinction. Fourth question, and the easiest question to one of the easiest questions to ask, but perhaps one of the more difficult ones to answer, is how do you differentiate yourself from the competition that are out there at the moment?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't have any competition. Then you are deluded and you will never get funded. I use social media, I use online and offline. I'm looking at alpha and beta and gamma, and all the way the angel is filtering you out. You know, first and foremost, you know, here's your succinct summary. Well, actually, I still don't understand it, so I'm just out at the first stage.
Yep.
Secondly, I don't believe there is any pain in the marketplace. I don't believe that's the way you solve the pain. I don't think that's how you market it. And then the killer comes back to the numbers, because it always comes back to the numbers. How much money are you looking for?
Yeah.
And what are you going to spend it on, just for a laugh? But as a subsection, does that, you're asking for £100,000, because people always ask for round numbers. No one ever asks for 86,712. Everyone always asks for £100,000. Does that £100,000 show any relation at all to the valuation that I, as an investor, put on your company? So if your company is worth 1 million, you're asking for 100,000, then by some quirk, I will want 10% of your company.
Does anyone really know? Do entrepreneurs know? Do angels know how to value businesses?
No.
That's no, what I thought.
Absolutely not. And I think, you know, there are, once again, we spend the gross national product of Guinea-Bissau on market research. And we ask our 4,000 angels, how do you go about valuing companies? How much time did you do due diligence? And the number one answer that falls out of how do you value a company is gut feel.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, I look at what the entrepreneur has told me. I half that. I look at what else is happening in the marketplace. I use my own knowledge of what's around in the marketplace and that sort of gut feel figure, and that's where I'm at. And, you know, it's that age-old tension between the entrepreneur who believes that his company is worth 100 million, although he hasn't sold anything yet,
yeah,
and the investor who could put up a very valid point that the company has very little value, and somewhere in between they strike a balance. But, you know, it's not to get too het up about it. If you fall out at the valuation stage, there are two mechanisms, two things to do. The first is don't feel too bad about it, because, you know, if you walk away from the deal, well, perhaps this isn't the investor that you should be having on board in any case.
Yeah.
If you can't agree on this, then, well, you know, it doesn't bode well for the future. The second thing is just forget about the valuation. And, you know, we can look at some other structuring. So you can look at convertible loan notes, which means that he doesn't give you 100,000 for 10%. He gives you 100,000. And whatever you get the next round of funding in that is the valuation that he plonks it down at, minus normally about 20%. It's kind of complex, but it's not complex. And it's just a way of getting around that icky subject. You know, if the investor wants on board badly enough, he'll invest. And if there's that sort of, if you guys are getting on well together, then, you know, the valuation really shouldn't stand in the way.
And in terms of finding angels, I mean, your way is one route, but I guess another good way is using your networks, finding people who know angels and who can affect a direct introduction for you.
Oh, it's not a good way. It's the best way.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. If you don't have to use an angel network, then don't. But be very careful as well about the amount of time that you think it's going to take.
So, what's your view of the way the angel market is now? What are angels hurting after the recession?
Yeah. I mean, when the balloon went up and the recession came down, to mix my metaphors, what I thought was going to happen was that our high net worths would be nursing sort of a damage to their net wealth of something like 34-35%, and they would then be nursing their own wounds and wouldn't be keen to invest. And I was wrong. What's happened is that our high net worths are nursing depletion in their net wealth of roughly 34-35%, and they're nursing their own wounds, but suddenly they have lost confidence in third-party advisors. So whereas some pimply youth at some huge financial advisor or merchant bank told them to invest, and they lost the money, and now they are not too sure exactly why they lost that money. So now what they want to do is actually get back on the horse themselves and do deals and look face to face. So whereas I thought it would really hurt our angels then and the angel marketplace, what we found is that the number of angels we have has more than doubled every month.
So a very positive outlook there from Bill at Angels Den. I then went on to speak to Daniel Waterhouse at VC firm Wellington Partners to get his view on the state of play and how entrepreneurs and growing businesses can make the most of their attempts to seek funding from the VC community.
Yeah, I'm Daniel Waterhouse. I'm a partner with Wellington Partners. We're a pan-European venture capital firm with investment offices in Munich and London. And we invest mainly in European companies at multiple stages, from fairly early to later in their development, primarily in the digital media and clean tech areas. And we've been doing this for 12 years or so now, and hopefully backing some of the great European success stories.
And how about some of those successes? What are the kind of the companies that people will know about that you've been behind?
Yeah, probably it's easier on the consumer internet side because they're more more household brands than some of the other companies. At the start of our life, we invested in some of the big success stories in Germany. We invested in a business called Orlando, which became eBay Germany. It was acquired by eBay to become eBay Germany. And a business called Immobilien Scout, which is like Rightmove for people who know that business in the UK. And more recently, we've been investors in a small music startup called Spotify, which hopefully some people have used, and a big advertising company called Adconian, a local search business called Quipe, Q-Y-P-E, and many more beyond.
Let's start by just perhaps looking at which businesses should be thinking about venture capital. For those businesses that are clearly growing and that are looking at their finance options, what types of business do you think suit that type of finance?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think people need to think quite hard about that. There's probably a few different ways to pick that apart, but primarily it's about scale and scalability. So is the company able to get big enough and do that in a highly scalable fashion? Because obviously venture capital is about trying to build very big businesses, and that's how our business model works, is to build big success stories and to do that in a very cost-efficient and scalable way. So how big is the prize that you're going after, and is that substantial enough to justify raising a significant amount of cash and then return enough to yourself and to the people who invest? Probably the other thing is really a mentality thing. So we're looking at the entrepreneurs who have the ambition to grow businesses at the same scale as us and to take the risk to do that. So this is not for the faint-hearted, because very few companies become worth hundreds of million pounds or billions of pounds in value. And to go there is going to be a pretty hair-raising journey. So really the entrepreneur needs to also want to be able to do that too.
Absolutely. Now, two sort of follow-on questions from that. Firstly, you talk about scale, and that obviously links to return in terms of you know, your business. What kind of multiples of return do you look at following an investment of, say, you know, 2 to 5 million?
Yeah, and two to 5 million is probably a relatively early stage of a company's life. So we can invest more, but usually when a company's a bit later. And the earlier, the higher return you're looking for, because unfortunately there will be some casualties along the way, and we have to build our model around assuming there will be some companies that don't make it and some will. So probably at that stage, you're looking to believe that there's at least a 10x return on that money. And the way to think about this is, if you're raising, let's keep the number simple, if you're raising £2 million, and typically, let's say you give away a quarter of the company for that, if that £2 million needs to grow by 10 times, that needs to become worth £20 million. And if you own a quarter, that means the company needs to become worth £80 million. So you have to believe that you're going in and pitching and convincing people you're going to build a company that's worth at least £80 million in that scenario.
And how patient are VCs? I mean, is this a kind of 2-year, 5-year, 10-year time scale? I mean, I know these things are all, you know, subject to the individual deal and the outlook for the, you know, the firm's business plans. But, you know, typically, what are the timescales that you ideally are looking for a return?
Well, the venture capital model usually, for most people, means they have funds where they have 10 years to invest and return the money. We're managing other people's money. We have 10 years to invest it and bring it back. So that typically means our horizon is 3 to 7 years for an investment, depending on stage and also stage of a fund. And it's worth, you know, if you ever raise venture capital, understanding where a firm is with their fund. Are they 3 or 4 years in? Of course, they've got less time to continue investing and return that money. But typically 3 to 7 years, unless things get hairy for the venture capitalists, then they have pressure put on them to return money earlier.
Yeah. So there's a kind of line of bosses, really.
Exactly. The buck doesn't stop with us. It stopped with us, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I wish it did.
The other interesting thing I've heard very, very, very frequently from all investors in businesses is that ultimately the people are probably, i.e. the entrepreneurs, are probably more important than the business, and that many decisions on investment comes down to the gut feel about whether you can work with the individual entrepreneur, whether you believe in them. Is that right?
Absolutely, 200% right. At the end of the day, so especially on the internet side, the ideas become commoditized pretty quickly, and you'll see lots of people trying to do the same business. And the difference between the ones that win and succeed and the ones that don't are the people and their operational and entrepreneurial excellence. And at the end of the day, that's top of the list. If we don't believe that this is a great team and great group of people who can grow and succeed, then it doesn't matter how good the idea is, we won't invest in that company. So top of the list.
An interesting part of the funding process is that many businesses will look initially, if they're going down to giving away some form of equity, will begin with some form of angel funding quite often. How should a business think about that transition from angel to VC funding as it grows? And what are the kind of issues around just the percentage share of the business that you're giving away? How should entrepreneurs and growing businesses manage that transition, bearing in mind that they already have some core investors? What's been your experience of handling those scenarios?
I think the transition and deciding to raise your first venture capital round really comes down to some of the things we talked about already in terms of, do you feel that you have a business that should get venture capital money and it's the right thing to do? And then have you proven enough that you're going to be able to justify raising the amount of money you're thinking about at a sensible valuation? Because valuation at the early stage of business really comes down to, not down to revenue growth or profitability, because it's early stage. It comes down to more, has the company proven that their product is compelling, that people want to use it, that they've built a great team, and then do they get lots of demand from investors around it? And the price really is then driven by demand. Or supply of capital from investors, yeah, as much as anything,
yeah,
in a rather perverse way. So it's really a feel for those things. Do you have enough evidence to convince somebody to give you a significant amount of money and that supports that this is going to become a big business? And then are you ready to take on that transition, both in terms of your capital structure, but in terms of the demands that investors will put on you, and having probably a more formal board where people will be keeping an eye on what happens in the business in the nicest possible way.
Yeah,
and that's a big change. It's probably a bit like going from, this may be a bad analogy, kind of casually dating an attractive girl to getting married and committing for a long time, if you like, and that's a big change psychologically.
Yeah. Different VC firms have different approaches to how they manage the board in terms of how they participate on a board of a company that they've invested in. And I know a lot of the Silicon Valley type VCs pioneered the very hands-on approach, but not all VCs are like that. What do you guys do at Wellington?
Yeah, I think we're pretty similar to the West Coast guys. We take board seats, and we believe, hopefully rightly, that our collective experiences, having worked in companies, ran companies, built companies, invested in lots of companies that have done well, means that we have a good perspective to help the entrepreneur navigate the difficult path ahead they'll have in whatever they're doing. This is not about interfering operationally and saying this is what you should do, this is what you should not do. This is about being a good sounding board for a management team, about kind of hopefully having some collective wisdom that we can share. It's kind of about pattern recognition. So having seen a lot of things before and spotting that pattern in a particular scenario and giving that insight and helping a company stop, not make too many mistakes. Everyone's going to make mistakes, but the less you make, the better.
Yeah.
So that should be a very constructive, collaborative dialogue between the kind of the board and the company, and we very much try and do that, and then bring other people in our network to participate in that.
It would be remiss of me not to come on to the kind of the difficult area, which is the fact that maybe 1 in 10 VC investments kind of make that big return. How many businesses just don't make it?
I think the number that don't make it is actually not that high. If I look at least from Wellington's experience, it's relatively few that really don't make it at all. There's usually, the ones that don't become an amazing success story, there's a way to find a reasonably happy ending in terms of a new home or a new solution where management carries on running the business or whatever.
Yeah.
But if, yeah, there's a few where it just, you know, the business model falls apart, the management team falls out, the competitor just wipes them out of the market, and that's really bad. And it's really tough for the entrepreneur. This is a much worse place to be, having one investment as an entrepreneur in one thing, than for us, where we have the luxury to invest across multiple places, although we hate to see any company not succeed.
You spread your risk, but as any entrepreneurs know, they kind of have that main burden.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's the reality.
That's the job, as it were. It's the job spec. Yeah. One other question linked to that is that you hear sometimes horror stories of entrepreneurs being ousted, you know, the founders being kicked off the board by the VC company. Now, I know this is a rare thing, but what advice would you give to the entrepreneurs themselves about how they should think about this transition process? Because, you know, being a startup founder is actually very different to being, you know, the MD of a company with investors to report to.
Well, I think the key thing is that they should think about it.
Yeah.
So I think it's a conversation we have with all teams before we invest, is just thinking about how things could evolve and how they feel about, you know, if things change and their role needs to change as the company gets bigger. As I said earlier, you know, that's a critical part of deciding whether you want to take venture capital and take on that next risk, is that's committing the organization and yourself to a certain path. And you need to reflect on whether, as an individual, you're going to grow with that or not, and whether you're happy to. A lot of people will say, fine, I know that I'm good at doing this, and I'll be very happy to stand down. Having said that, you know, one of the things that makes great entrepreneurs great is that they're kind of tenacious, stubborn, pig-headed, all these things. And so, you know, that by definition can cause this to be quite difficult later on.
Yeah.
So I think the main thing is to be very upfront about it and very transparent with an investor on kind of your personal motivations and how you see things working out over time and how they see it.
Yeah.
So that there's no surprise if at some point it becomes apparent to everyone that there needs to be some sort of change because the business has got to a certain scale.
And traditionally, in those circumstances, or when somebody, when an exit occurs, whether it's a good result, which hopefully it is, or whether it's an early departure for somebody within the company, how does the equity and the return work?
Well, usually a founder has granted themselves some ownership of the company when they founded it, and they may have been diluted a bit as they've raised money, and they may have either set things up with their investors such that all of their shares are theirs, regardless of what happens, or they may have what's called a vesting schedule where some of their shares come to them the longer they stay in the organization. But whatever's there is there, right?
Yeah.
The point of a change. And usually a founder will leave with, you know, a good chunk of a business.
Mm.
Now, where it becomes trickier is if they lose voting control or influence on the board, and if there's then a difficult transaction, which means that some of the shareholders get disadvantaged. And then they may get aggrieved, and this is probably where you hear the horror stories as well. There's down rounds or cram down rounds and all these great phrases where people get a bit aggressive.
Yeah.
But generally, that's just not very constructive.
Absolutely.
At the end of the day, what makes, you know, if you look at the great success stories, that wasn't where people got screwed over or were took advantage of. It's where everyone stays aligned and motivated and towards the same goal.
Yeah. And I mean, in essence, it's, you know, that's part of a successful business, regardless of funding source, really, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. At least that's what we're striving to do is to be involved in those situations, not involved in taking advantage of more. You know, some people do that where they take advantage of distress situations or difficult situations and take an unfair economic position, but that's not the business we're in.
No, exactly. Now, of course, when you've successfully secured your first round of venture capital, and if the business continues to grow, potentially there's demand for, you know, more liquidity within the business and more to help strengthen that growth as it goes through. There's also potentially demand and competition among VCs for B rounds and further rounds of investment down the line. Should entrepreneurs be, and can they bring in more than one VC at later round stages?
I think follow-on financing with new investors is very common in the way these things develop. And if you look at, I think pretty much every investment we've got, we have co-investors and other VCs in there. And that makes sense for lots of reasons. One, you know, if you as an investor, if you do the early stage, and the ones that are successful, you're trying to take advantage that you got in cheaper because you took the risk earlier, and then other people come in a bit later and you don't have to put all that money into the business, and you protect your shareholding, but you don't have to invest quite so much, and that's, you know, gets offset by the risk of doing the earlier investment. But also, you know, as a company grows, it's good to have several parties around the table. It's good to have a reasonably unconcentrated investor base, because that doesn't mean there's any one person with too much power around the shareholder group and the board. And also they get multiple parties to help them and give different perspectives, which is helpful.
Yeah. Let's just move on to the kind of the VC scene currently. I was in a room full of VCs a couple of years ago, or maybe not 18 months ago, just about 6 months after the big financial crash. And the prevailing mood amongst them was for new businesses, forget VC funding for the moment. We're only concentrating on sort of doubling down on our existing investments, and there's just not a lot of new cash or sort of new investment around for you right now. What's your view currently of the market in terms of just in terms of the money you have to invest?
So you have to remember that, you know, every 3 or 4 years we have to go out and raise money from funder funds, from pension companies, insurance companies, and they sit back and have to decide whether they want to deploy money into the venture capital class. And of course, after the economic crisis, they were in a difficult position because a lot of their investments were in a tough spot. And so for funds who were about to come up to having to raise money, it suddenly looked pretty bleak. And so a lot of VCs had to say, hang on a second, we need to preserve our remaining funds. Or a lot of them said, we're going to have to prove really quickly that we can make money for our investors and do later stage deals rather than these kind of high risk, longer term things. So I think that had a bit of a dynamic. In 2009, we actually, I think, 6 or 8 new investments and just carried on. So hopefully we're in a strong position that we're kind of a relatively big venture capital firm. We're well established and we've been doing this for a while. And so our policy is, we should just keep doing what we do, because the cycles will even out. And history says actually there's a pretty much even number of successful companies created every year, regardless of what's happening in the world.
Yeah.
And so we just keep going. But I think from the market in general, it has been tough because people have been constrained. That's beginning to thaw out. Although I think there's still been a structural shift with less people doing earlier stage and more people doing later stage.
Yeah.
Which for us is great because we see some less competition there, which is always a good thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
But it's getting better, but I'd say it's still tough, and it's a very long-term cycle to change all this.
Obviously, you guys specialise in green tech, which one would anticipate is quite a hot market. What do you see as the kind of areas in particular that VCs will be finding attractive over the next 2 or 3 years?
I think it will continue to be those two buckets. I think if you look across the piece, there's a lot of money in the digital media internet space and putting more funds doing that. And I think that continues. There's no real change in the speed of progress. And actually, I think mobile internet is given another kind of second or third or fourth wind where we are. So that seems to be relentless, amazingly enough. I think clean tech will only get more interesting. We've actually been doing it for 5 or 6 years now, whereas a lot of people have only just begun turning their attention to it. There's a few specialised funds, but not that many in Europe, and we only see that getting more and more interesting. So we kind of invest in solar, in renewable energy, in energy storage, in waste management, all of these things, and actually we're just at the beginning of that cycle.
Mm. Do you think that particular part of the, you know, the entrepreneurial economy, as it were, is very much dependent on how keen governments are to support, stroke, subsidise that sector?
That's definitely a factor, but I think that there's now just a general awareness in the world and amongst people that we have to change some things, and people want to do that. there's also just a reality that we're running out of resources and things are getting more expensive. So there's an economic driver from corporations to find new technologies and to change things, which is independent of government stimulus. Yeah. So I think there's a bunch of things going on there. But undoubtedly, if you look at the solar market in Germany, that's been considerably boosted by the economic incentives put in place by the government.
Finally, three tips for entrepreneurs, founders, on how they should prepare themselves and their business for VC funding once they've made the decision to go for it.
One, check that you really believe you want to do this and that your ambition is big enough and your dream is big enough and that the prize is big enough. So sense check yourself that you're entering into something with the right story and the right belief. Two, just get the proposition really tight. So we see too many people who spend forever trying to explain what the business is, and a great business and a great entrepreneur should be able to really put their finger on it in 5 minutes and explain to you what they're doing and why it's important and why it solves a problem. Three, you need to try and reach the VC community through, a trusted network. So we all say this, but cold calling and blind emails really doesn't give us a lot of enthusiasm for the strength of the entrepreneur, because a good entrepreneur should be able to find a way to get in front of us and make us pay attention to them, and a blind email doesn't do that.
All good advice, Daniel Waterhouse. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Nice talking to you.
So there we are. Good interview there with Daniel Waterhouse from Wellington Partners. Thanks very much to him. Hope you enjoyed this week's episode of the podcast. As I said earlier, do spread the word, and do also stay tuned for more episodes in this series with the British Library. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.